court will proceed to the fifth case of the day, Watson v. Englund. Frank?
May it please the court. It's my pleasure today to represent Mr. Jesse Watson in his appeal before you. Mr. Watson should be granted habeas corpus relief for two major reasons. He was denied the effective assistance of trial counsel. He was denied the effective assistance of appellate counsel in his appeal. With respect to his effective assistance of counsel, with respect to his trial counsel claim, there are two major issues that I'd like to cover with you today, time permitting. The first is that an improper jury instruction, an incomplete and improper jury instruction, was submitted at trial that his trial counsel failed to object to and his appellate counsel failed to raise on appeal.
Mr. Frank, it would be helpful for me anyway if you would focus on the prejudice part of the Strickland analysis, because I'm willing to believe that it was error and let's even assume failure of constitutionally effective performance to let those jury instructions go forward. But how can you possibly show prejudice on this record?
Well, I think we can show prejudice, Your Honor, because an essential element of the crime was left open, and the jury was allowed to give their own definition as to what first-degree murder meant.
But don't you think on these facts that no rational jury could have failed to find that Mr. Watson intended to kill the various people he encountered?
I do believe the facts allow for, I guess your point is,
let's take it person by person. There's Pearl, and he puts the gun up against her head and pulls the trigger several times.
Right.
There's the guy who throws his arm up, you know, while he's trying to shoot him in the head. There's somebody else who gets shot under the arm. I find it very difficult to imagine how, even if there was error, the state court and then the district court below thought that prejudice couldn't be shown.
I certainly understand your concerns, Your Honor, and the way I would address it is that intent to kill had to be shown with respect to each and every victim. And here, with the jury instructions, I believe that there are different varying levels of intent that one could infer based on the defendant's conduct. Because that's all we have in this case. We don't have any statements by the defendant. All we have is what he did in that house that day. What I would say with respect to...
So when you barge into somebody's living room and just start shooting randomly, you couldn't be said to have had an intent to kill everybody within range?
Well, Your Honor, not just from the use of a firearm and pointing a gun. The Holmes case tells us that just by pointing a gun at somebody and shooting doesn't necessarily mean you can infer the intent to kill. Now, what I would say with respect to him putting the gun against Pearl's head, there's no evidence that Mr. Watson didn't know that the gun was already empty at that point. So there is the argument there. But what I would...
What I would
rather focus on is the fact that the reason why we have prejudice in this case is because at the end of the day, the jury was allowed to infer for themselves what first-degree murder meant. They weren't given the proper instruction as to you must find intent to kill with respect to each and every victim in this case. And there were three convictions with respect to attempt murder.
So who's the victim that you think the evidence was weakest with respect to the intent to kill?
With respect to Clifford and Dormothelia. Because Clifford was hospitalized, Dormothelia was not. And so I would say it's weakest with respect to those. And so I think it's important, though, to focus in on that the jury was left to its own devices in this case, and they could have used a knowing standard and said, well, he knew that by walking into a room and firing a weapon that he could cause grave bodily harm. We don't know, and we can't at this point now, reach back and look into their minds and say, well, why did the jury convict Mr. Watson? Did they know or did they believe at that time that he had the specific intent to kill, which is what is required?
Now, they did find that he intended to commit murder.
The instruction that was given...
Are you talking about the definition of murder? Everybody knows what murder is, I'm not sure.
Certainly, murder can be synonymous for kill. The real problem is that we're missing the essential...
In what respect isn't it synonymous?
Well, because under our standard, you have to have a specific intent to kill. You can't be, you knew that there was a high propensity to cause grave bodily injury. The reality of the situation here is the jury could have made their own decision that he knew by going in there and firing a weapon into a room full of people that he could have caused grave bodily injury or something that might have resulted in death. What they needed to be instructed on was Mr. Watson had to have the specific intent to kill. And that's the critical.
How is that any different from having a specific intent to commit the offense of first-degree murder?
Well, the problem there, Your Honor, is that first-degree murder is undefined. And what we're missing, again, is this.
It certainly means killing, doesn't it?
But it can also mean other things, Your Honor. And that's the problem.
What else does it mean? If, I mean, isn't killing a part of all of the meanings that you're thinking of, though?
Well,
I can't think of a single instance in the law. Maybe I've overlooked something where murder doesn't involve the death of someone, the killing of someone.
That's true, Your Honor. And the problem, though, we're missing is the intent to kill. And intimate.
But would you call it murder if somebody, you know, somebody accidentally mixed up the medications and negligently caused the death of a person? You wouldn't call that murder.
Well, certainly the person would be killed in that instance.
Well, he'd be dead, but yeah. If you'd call it negligent homicide or something, you wouldn't call
right.
it murder.
Right. You know, our concern is when we're looking at the prejudice prong, we're concerned that these jurors were not instructed that Mr. Watson had to have the specific intent to kill with respect to each one of these victims.
Yeah.
And the murder and the reason why the jury instructions are the way they are, I think, is to prevent this exact kind of situation. The reality is, under Illinois law, that supplemental instruction, the 701A, first-degree murder definition, absolutely had to be included in the instruction, and it wasn't. To rule otherwise now would really obviate the need for that in the future. And I think there's a good reason why we want to make sure that when we're charging people with attempt crimes, that the underlying crime is clearly defined so that they can make a good decision with respect to the person's intent. So I think that is very important. Next, I'd like to move on to the ineffective assistance of counsel with respect to the plea negotiations. Mr. Watson was offered a plea deal, which he rejected. It was 20 or 24 years, depending on the record that you look at. But the reality was, what's clear from this case is that his trial counsel did not inform him that he faced mandatory consecutive sentences. His trial counsel also failed to tell him the correct maximum potential sentence, which was 120 years as opposed to 60 years.
So I have a question for you. Do you regard it as a question of fact or as a question of law when one tries to decide whether the difference between an exposure of 120 years versus 60 years would have caused Mr. Watson to respond differently to the plea? He thinks it's 60 years, and he rejects either the 20 or 24-year plea, thinking that it's 60. And so the courts before us have all decided that the difference between 60 and 120 isn't enough to make us think he would have come to a different decision. But is that a fact issue or a law issue?
Well, I think it's both, because we have to look at what the facts say he said or would have done, and also the law with respect to would the outcome have been different? If he had the correct advice from counsel, would the outcome have been different under
Curry? Even that question, though, would the outcome have been different? Would his behavior have changed? It sounds facty to me.
Well, there's certainly a factual element to it, because we have to look at, because we know under Curry, we have to look at, is there some other objective evidence that would lead us to believe that he would have made a different decision? In this case, I do believe there is, because his statement that he would have considered the plea deal at 60 years, because that's not at the 120 years, is evidence of that. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time, and I'd like to reserve that if possible. So thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Frank. Mr. Malamuth?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Eldad Malamuth, here today on behalf of Respondent. This Court should affirm the dismissal of Petitioner's ineffective assistance habeas claims because he has not demonstrated that the State Court was unreasonable in rejecting them. Now, turning first to the jury instruction issue. Petitioner, his claim is that the counsel is ineffective for failing to secure an additional instruction defining first-degree murder, which would have included an intent to kill. But petitioner can show neither deficient performance nor prejudice for three reasons.
Well, wait a minute. On the performance side, though, it seems to me, as a matter of state law, which of course is not our issue, but as a matter of state law, the Illinois pattern jury instructions did require more than this jury was told. So there's a mistake, isn't there, even if you're not going to say it was a mistake of such colossal proportions as to be deficient performance?
Your Honor is correct that the additional instruction was required under this committee note, and that certainly probably would have been best practices to request
it. Well, it was a mistake. Those are the state court says this is what you're supposed to do instruction-wise.
That's exactly right, Your Honor, and it's best practice to make no mistake, I guess. But given that it's a mistake, the question is whether the conduct was within the realms of reasonable performance, whether that whether his performance was reasonable. And in this case, whether the jury was properly instructed with respect to the intent requirement, and whether there was reason to believe that the jurors had that knowledge. And here there were plenty of reasons to believe that the jury jurors had just that knowledge. First, the instructions, as discussed, required an intent to murder. As Your Honor pointed out, everyone knows that murder means a killing. When you intend to murder, that means you intend to kill. The fact that murder can be, the fact that the offense of first-degree murder might have other intent mental states which might satisfy it, doesn't change the fact that that to intend to murder means intending to kill. So in other words, that intent requirement is separate than the other intent requirements that might satisfy first-degree murder. Second, the closing arguments in this case made clear that there was an intent to kill. The closing argument of petitioner, as well as the state, included the words intent to kill. So
why doesn't that go to, I mean, it may not matter from your point of view, but why doesn't all of that go to the prejudice side of things as opposed to the deficient performance side? I mean, I can easily see on the prejudice side the fact that both counsel are calling the jury's attention to intent to kill might ameliorate what's gone on.
Your Honor, it goes to both. It certainly goes to prejudice. And it goes to prejudice in that the question is there a reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different? Is there a reasonable probability that these jurors actually did not know that they needed to find an intent to kill? And certainly when the instructions say intent to murder, when the closing arguments say intent to kill, there's just no reasonable probability at that point that the jurors didn't know this and that the outcome would have been different. But as to the deficient performance, again, the question is whether his conduct was reasonable. And in that sense, having the instructions, including that specific language, intent, in the closing arguments, makes his conduct, on the whole, reasonable. It's not outside the bounds of what reasonable performance is. The fact that there was this mistake, as Your Honor has described it, does not mean that his performance, on the whole, was unreasonable. Moreover, again, as has already been discussed, there's no reasonable probability that the outcome would have been different because the evidence of intent was overwhelming. In this case, the petitioner shot his ex-wife in the stomach. He shot her. He later put the gun to her head and pulled the trigger.
What about Clifford and Dormalitha, the two that your opponent said the evidence is less clear on?
Well, with respect to Clifford, the evidence is that he was running away as trying to flee as the as he was being shot at, and that he ended up being shot in the arm that was raised to protect his head. So the petitioner shot at the man's head, as well as hit him in the leg while he was running away. Between aiming at his head and shooting him, close in his body as he was fleeing, is certainly pretty overwhelming evidence that there was intent to kill him. And with respect to the daughter, she was shot in the arm. And additionally, another man was shot who had thrown his arm across her to protect her. So she's shot in basically near the torso, and another man is shot in his arm, which is flung in front of her. So that's pretty overwhelming evidence. And with respect to the idea that he may have known that the gun was not loaded, there's simply no test. There's no evidentiary support for that. There's no evidence that he was counting the shots, that he had a certain amount of bullets and knew that. That is, it's just a purely theoretical possibility that's been presented here on appeal for the first time.
Does the record happen to show what kind of weapon he was using?
Your Honor, I don't believe the record does include the make of the gun. Now,
with the caliber, is that?
Right. I don't think that's before this court, the caliber of the weapon. Now, petitioner's second claim is that he received...
Well, of course, that might affect his intent. If he's using a .22 rifle, the chances of killing somebody are a lot less than if you're using a .45.
That's right, Your Honor. And if the petitioner had put forward that kind of evidence, maybe we'd be asking those questions. But there simply is no evidence of that. And that argument has just simply not been raised. And even a .22, I'm not a weapons expert, but fired in short range at people's bodies and heads displays an intent to kill. That's pretty overwhelming. Now, turning towards...
That would be a little better shot than this fellow.
that's probably right. Now, turning towards petitioner's second argument, which is that he received... ineffective assistance of counsel at the plea negotiation stage. His argument is that he wasn't told that he faced consecutive sentences, which could have added up to 120 years, only told that he faced a possibility of 60 years. Now, assuming deficient performance, as the state court did, there's just no reasonable probability, which he must show, that he would have accepted the plea. He has not made that demonstration. The evidence shows that petitioner hoped to be convicted of reckless conduct, that he believed that there was nothing intentional about his conduct and that he would be found guilty of something, but only reckless conduct. Reckless conduct has a maximum sentence in Illinois of 1 year at the time, and that's what he was hoping for. And there's simply no evidence that if he was weighing 1 year versus 60 years and 1 year versus 120 years, that would have made a difference. Now, even with respect to the 24-year plea, no reason to believe that the 24, it's not reasonable that weighing the 24 versus 60 versus 24 versus 120 is automatically constitutes an important difference. If you look at cases in which prejudice has been found, that the levels are much closer. So, for instance, in Moore, he was offered a plea of 10 years and told he at trial he would face at least 22 and up to 27 years. In reality, he faced between 12 and 15 years. So there, the calculus was much closer. And so there are no facts here which would suggest that it changed his analysis, and there's no legal reason. There's no, as a matter of law, there's no reason to impute some sort of significance to the difference between that. And so he just again has shown no reasonable probability that there will be that the outcome would have been different. And if your honors have no further questions, we ask that the court affirm the dismissal of petitioner's habeas claims.
Thank you, Mr. Malley. Mr. Frank.
Thank you, Your Honors. Very briefly, wanted to touch base on the plea negotiations issue. I believe there are facts that support a ruling that he would have made a different decision. One, when he said that he would consider a plea agreement, that was when he was viewing against 60 years as opposed to 120 years. And another one that the state brought up here is that he knew he was going to be found guilty of something. He had no hope of being acquitted in this case. There was absolutely no chance of that happening, and he was well aware of that fact. So the fact that he would willfully put himself in jeopardy, knowing that his maximum sentence would be 120 years and that he's facing mandatory consecutive sentences, neither of which he was advised prior to his trial, the belief that neither of those things would have any effect on whether he would make a different decision just really defies logic. It would have to make sense that he would have considered those two points, because that's obviously going to impact him greatly. The last thing I wanted to touch on is the argument that I see my time's up. The intent to kill instruction was argued in closing argument. The judge is required to instruct the jury on the law, and they are obliged to follow the judge's instructions. And just because the argument was made in closing argument, we don't believe satisfies the standard. We ask that the court grant habeas corpus.
Thank you, Mr. Frank. All right, thanks to all counsel. Mr. Frank, I want to give you an additional thanks from the court for accepting this appointment and ably representing Mr. Watson on appeal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Case is taken under advisement.